Lady's choice.
Ooh, wild card option. Okay, anybody reveal anything about their life, anything at all.
I've gotten two annulments. One for pleasure and one to cap off a long con. I was running against Keith Sweat.
Wow.
Ethel, have you... Okay, Ethel's asleep. Shauna?
I'm writing a memoir based on my blog. It's called Tweeping Up Appearances, and it's about my journey to find happiness by smiling through the pain.
Okay, I can work with that.
TBTL.
Guess what day it is? Guess what day it is?
It's Friday. Friday. Gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend.
And it's time to slay all day.
Yeet. Stay woke, beyond fleek, and get that Gucci breakfast.
Goal.
Stop. Stop telling this. I'm gonna puke.
You know, you're overthinking it, buddy. Yeah. I mean, just kind of see this as a fun thing to do where you make a little bread.
The comedy factor speaks for itself. It's just painfully obvious.
What?
It's an unfulfilled prophecy. It just has to be played out.
Well, good morning and welcome to a Friday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live. Coming to you today from rainy Portland, Oregon. And the sixth floor of the Jupiter Next Hotel. I got to tell you, the weather, oh my God. The weather is lousy, but the view is good, was what I was about to tell you. But I am looking out at a scene. I wish there was a way I could take a picture of it with my eyeballs and send it to you. I'm sure that technology is not far behind. But there's a crane. There's a massive construction site. And there's a huge crane. This is just framed against the Portland skyline. And I look out, and this huge crane is just lifting two porta-potties through the air. Two of those standard porta-johns are just sailing through the sky in Portland like two beautiful, shit-filled birds. God, that's the imagery. The imagery here on episode 2873 in the Collector series is already quite something. We're going to have to rely on the imagery because I realized when I got down here to Portland that I forgot to bring my special mini-to-mini cable, which longtime listeners of the show will be familiar with as a topic. So it means I can't play my little sound effects. So as I tell you about things and introduce people like, say, Cobros, you just need to insert your own little sound effects in your mind. And I know you can do it if you've been listening to the show for a while because we got like 20 sound effects and we play them all the time. So, here's the part where Tom Shane would say, let the fun begin. And I would tell you that we have a couple of food-related topics to talk about during our top stories. I would say, you know what's tired, apparently? Buffet restaurants. And you know what's wired? Adult ball pits, sometimes associated with restaurants. And then you would hear this sound effect, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. And then because I said tired and wired, you would be hearing, I cannot believe he just told that joke. So those are all things that would have been happening if I had my special sound effects cord here, which I don't. Then I would mention that because it's Friday, we're also going to do music for your weekend. And that we've got emails and V-mails. And that we have this guy, the longest running Cobro of the show, as I've already mentioned. He's known for his drawings of tall ships, their grace and their beauty, as I have not yet mentioned. He might have tacos for dinner tonight. He's not quite sure about it yet. Here he is having the time of his life. And then you would hear me say, you'd hear me play, he is Andrew, oh, explicit, Walsh. And he joins me right now from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Good morning, and I'm sorry.
That was wonderful. That was like poetry. And it gave me an idea. I honestly would like to try this. The next time you are somewhere without... without your cable,
audio
your dongle, whatever it takes to play these drops, why don't you map it out like you just did and know what drops you want to play and just let me know in advance and I'll write them out and you'll pause and I'll just do my imitation of them. I think that would be fantastic. And can we get through the whole intro without cracking?
That's the big question. And can I get through the whole intro without witnessing unintentional construction site visual poetry? known as two porta potties. Just, I mean, seriously, 300 feet off the ground. I've never seen anything like it, Andrew.
I'm going to take some of the fun out of this and guess that they're probably clean, right? No. I don't think they put them on a. I'm sure they empty them before they put them in the sky, right? Before they send them flying, as they say.
No, but they might have been. I think they were taking them down. They were replacing them.
Mm.
Oh, here's what I can tell you. And by the way, the same crane is now. Yes, this is what the show is going to be today, everybody. You're welcome. The same crane is now pulling up, like the whatever you'd call it, the cable I'm looking at, and the cable is sans porta potty. And my theory is these were porta potties that were on the top level of this construction site on Burnside, if you're scoring along at home.
Okay.
And I believe that they were being lowered down to the ground because they were full. That's what I choose to believe.
Yeah.
I choose to believe that they were maxed out.
Wow.
And now they're being although I'll tell you one other thing, and then I promise you I will stop with the narration of this construction site, which is apparently the most interesting construction site in the world. Now on the, and it's like 3-4 blocks away from me, but on the top level, what I can also see is a guy in an orange construction vest full on sprinting. Now this is an unfinished, this is just like an open air, like it's at the kind of foundational level of the building stage. So it's like, imagine a big cement giant floor of what will eventually be a building, but right now it's just cement and it's probably 7-8 stories in the air. A guy was running on the top giant thing of cement. Running. I've never seen anyone sprint on a construction site. You know, they're like big on the no running at the pool at the Holiday Inn in Pacoima. The fact that like someone's sprinting on top of like an 8-story not closed in building is also something I've never seen. Today is a day of firsts, Andrew, for me and the listeners. This is the first time they've realized just how bad the show is.
You want to know how I've been spending my morning hours?
Yes.
Reading emails from listeners in Australia that are freaking me out.
Oh, I forgot. I was also going to play a drop that says, I am petrified, petrified by this story. That was going to be, and that is not my impression of Underdog from the Howard Stern universe, but shout out to P. Fletch and other people who get that reference. I was going to play that drop because, yeah, I've also been getting those, and I was kind of hoping you weren't getting them, and then I noticed you were looped in. I was hoping that they were missing you with that information, because now I'm wondering if you're still going to agree to do this cockamamie drive, which we announced yesterday, by the way, that we, the last week of May, are going to roll up in Australia at the world's largest lobster, or at least Australia's largest lobster, and then we're going to drive. The plan is to drive all the way up to a town in the Northern Territory called Larrimah. And the response from the listeners has been immediate and it has been consistent, which is, this is a terrible, dangerous idea.
Snakes. A lot of people concerned about snakes. Got an email from Kristen, who, this is an interesting thing. I'm learning already a lot about Australia. In Australia, you don't need the H in Kristen.
Yep.
It's spelled just C-R-I-S-T-I-N, which I like. It saves time. I'm guessing I'm not the only Aus-10 you're hearing from. I feel like I need to say that driving up the middle of the country is a worrying undertaking. All of the concerns you mentioned, not being able to find gas, not having Wi-Fi or cell coverage or even accommodation, are very real possibilities. Not to mention, it's quite dangerous with snakes and other animals. I don't know many Australians who would do this trip. Take it for what it's worth, but I just don't feel right not saying something. If you are in any way up for reconsidering your destinations, I know that we can suggest plenty of suitably weird and fascinating places for you to check out, but maybe in safer areas. That's from Kristen.
Is it possible that we're just tougher than your average outback Australian?
No. I was wondering that today because I was watching. This is how nervous I'm becoming. I was watching clips, not even clips. I was watching GIFs of Crocodile Dundee for the newsletter and seeing him with wild animals, having read these emails, petrified me. Like, I was like, I can't calm a wildebeest like that, or whatever the hell he's calming in that thing. John wants to remind us, I don't want to add too much stress to you, he says, but they drive on the left side of the road down there, and the steering wheel is on the right side of the car. Having driven on a couple of road trips in the UK in the past, I just want to let you know that you do get used to it after a couple of days. It does feel weird and scary at first, especially after doing right turns. Also, it's very common to bump the left curb with the car's tires because you're not used to the orientation. The driving thing, like, whatever, we'll figure that out. Although it would be nicer if we were starting, this is the one thing, if we were starting in a rural area, a non-populous area, then we could get our wheels underneath us, so to speak, and then by the time we get to the city, we'd have the whole wrong side of the road thing down. I know they consider it the right side of the road, but whatever. Instead, we're going to be learning how to drive in the busiest part of our road trip.
I like the idea of us driving on the wrong side of the highway somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and someone drives by and goes, "You're going on the wrong side." And then Planes, Trains, and Automobiles style, we go, "How do they know where we're going?" People are following us. The entire cast of Mad Max Fury Road is behind us, including the guy who's chained up with the fire guitar. And they're all just trying to yell, God, "You're on the wrong side of the road." There's motorcycle guys jumping over us.
How do they know where we're going? Anyway, yeah, that snakes thing. I think that we really are. We need to do some really heavy planning and mapping. I mean, down to the gas station, I think.
Yeah, okay, that one does give me a little pause. I will tell you a couple things. One, somebody better get these mother-humping snakes off this mother-humping TBTL-a-thon. Sorry, that was, like, in me, and I had to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I encountered, did I tell you this, on my hike in the greater San Diego area, when I hiked up to Potato Chip Rock, I ended up coming back and taking kind of a, well, you know, as the poet said, I took the path less traveled. And I ended up crossing paths with a juvenile rattlesnake. Did I tell you this?
No.
And it was cool, man. Like, I feel like the snake and I, we got each other. Now, granted, it wasn't full grown, so maybe if it was full grown, I would have been more freaked. But I looked at it. It looked at me. Kind of had a little just moment, and then I made a short video of it and tried to get it to rattle its tail, which it wouldn't do, and then which I guess meant it wasn't scared, and then I kind of just gave it a wide berth, and that was it. So what I'm basically saying, Andrew, is I think I know my way around a snake.
The line dropped for a second. I'm not joking. The line dropped for a very critical part of that story. What did you do to try to get it to rattle its tail, and are you being serious?
I didn't do anything like to antagonize it. I didn't, you know, try to hit it with something. I just was standing there, and I figured if it gets afraid of me, it's going to rattle its tail. And I also was trying to zoom in with my camera phone and get a picture of the tail to prove that this was a rattlesnake, because you could see, you know, the classic tail of a rattlesnake. Granted, this was a teenager. This was not a like huge full-on diamondback rattler full grown. That would have freaked me out. But I also feel like I handled myself. Let's just say I did not accidentally soil myself, which would have been what I would have maybe thought I was going to do when encountering a rattlesnake in the wild. So I think I got this.
That's my Outback buddy, everybody. This is my this is the guy who tried to get the rattlesnake to rattle its snake for Instagram. This is the guy that I'm going into this with. Just so everybody knows. So anyway,
I made a TikTok video of my death.
We didn't know. We've said on this show a million times, like, what is the end game for TBTL? Can we keep this going forever? And the answer is no. I'm going to die of venom from a rattlesnake. And well, maybe the show will go on, but the chance of me surviving this trip, I realize, is smaller than I originally thought.
I got a couple thoughts on this, okay? One, maybe part of it is, first of all, I agree with you 100% on the gas thing. Like, that's mission critical, as they say. So we definitely need to make sure that we are able to get gas. The other thing is, you know, you and I had talked about just bringing camping gear. And so then we're less dependent on being able to stay in a motel or what have you, or shack, if we can just camp. But then you throw the snakes into the equation.
Yep.
And the dingoes, and I am bringing a few of my babies, so I don't want the dingoes getting at them. So that's a concern, but maybe what we can do is we've already reserved one rental car with Hertz of Australia. We'd like to welcome new sponsor, Hertz of Australia. Hertz.au. I know, right?
Yeah.
We're renting a car from Hertz, and I think it's basically the size of a Yaris. It's a car that, I mean, I don't know if it's actually the car that we will get, because I think that it's more like they just tell you the kind of car. But the kind of car that they're offering us at the price point that we have is, like, I would say smaller than a Yaris, bigger than a bread box. Like, and it's a brand of, it's called like a Mitsubishi Sprint. It's like some kind of car they don't have in the States.
It's a noise. Our car is a
it's a Mitsubishi. Oh my. But so maybe what we could do, if it's not a lot more expensive, is maybe we could move up to something more like a kind of a small van or something. Like, maybe we could do something tricky where we just actually sleep in the car. Like, if we get a little bit bigger car, mm-hmm. so that we're snake proof.
When you said camping the first time, I guess we might have had a bad line that time too, because I thought you said glamping, and that's more what I'm into. Are people still glamping? Doesn't that mean that basically you're car camping, only you've brought Uggs and a comfy couch?
I don't think that the car part of it is necessarily a big factor. I think that the glamping aspect is that it's very glamorous. It's, you know, the tent can be up on some kind of built platform. It's usually, my sense is, it's usually like a place that's set up for you. So you go out to, like, the alleged wilderness in Montana. But when you get there, there's like a beautiful white canvas tent that, like my rattlesnake, is very Instagrammable. And it's got, like, there's, you know, it's got soft lighting, and there's rosé on ice, and it's very, like, well, it's very glamorous, but you are technically outdoors. But it's been all set up in advance, and it's not like it's cheap. That is my sense of glamping. And yes, my friend, I would glamp through the outback with you happily.
Glamping through the outback. Is it too late to change the name of the project?
No.
Glamping through the outback, a TBTL radio special.
So I guess, look, first of all, thank you, everybody. And sorry about my voice. I don't know what's going on today. I was saying before we started recording that, like, I guess I'm at the age where if I host a radio show on stage the night before, like I did last night, I guess my voice then is recovering the next day, which is the saddest thing. I've always had a really low, not low opinion, but I've always had kind of a hard eye roll over people who treat their voice. I don't mean singers. Like, I get it if you're Marie Callas or something. Like, if you're, you know, if you're a singer, or maybe a voiceover artist or something, it kind of matters. But, like, I have never been like, my voice is my instrument. And people who are like, hot tea and honey and, oh, I'm on vocal rest today. Again, outside of literally being a singer, I've always been like, let's not get too precious with this. But I may have moved into the phase of my life where I have to kind of be like, oh, did LiveWire Thursday night? Well, Friday morning, I'm going to be feeling it in the voice department. But anyway, all of which is to say, sorry about my voice. And everybody, really do send us your fears about this, because even though I don't want Andrew seeing those messages because I worry that he'll kibosh the whole deal, although, Andrew, you have more moxie than you let on. I think you're more – here's the thing. I think you're more interested in this being a compelling narrative than you are worried about us getting bitten by snakes, and I like that about you.
Hmm. Yeah, maybe they're equal footing.
Okay, but
I mean,
I'll take 50-50.
Like, I mean, I want this to be, I want this to be interesting. And, like, if we were just to, as you said, kind of, you know, in planning meetings or kind of our go-to thing, is like, if we're going to do a special TBTL from Australia, I don't want it to be just like, hey, we're at the Sydney Opera House and we're, you know, we're like tourists and we're just having a really good time and this is fun. Like, that's for vacation. This is for TBTL, and we want to make it interesting. The listeners, I think, are saying maybe you're making it too interesting. I don't know.
Is there a way to structure the TBTL-a-thon so if we die, the donations then are converted into funds for our memorial/funeral?
That's interesting. I don't think I have that clause in my contract. I think it says, oh, my God, what do you think? What do you think about the paperwork we're going to have to sign for this one? Remember the paperwork we had to sign before we went hitchhiking in these United States? And it said, like, death by fire, death by bear, death by dragon. It, like, covered all of its bases for APM. Imagine what this one's going to look like.
So this is that means it's official. You're going to tell APM we're doing this?
You didn't know that I was I've been sending notes to my to the bosses all along saying Luke's gonna make me do this thing. Somebody stop him.
Seriously though, I'm not joking. For folks that are in Australia, that's the other thing that's cool about being from Australia. Apparently, not only do you spell Kristen differently, you don't even need the Aus. You just go Australia.
Yeah, I saw that. We got, cool, by man. The way, we got emails from, since yesterday's show alone, we got emails from, I believe, three different Australtens, and we didn't get one from, listener Linda, who we, so we know she's
Power
out there.
Out.
Listener
Power
Linda.
Neg.
We've met her before, so we know she's out there, too. So we have at least four people living in Australia who listen to this show. Isn't that interesting? I'll bet you
we
there's
have
more.
Meaning we have at least four people we can call if we're stuck somewhere in the Northern Territory, if our Yaris is cornered by snakes.
That's exactly what I put in today's newsletter. I said, if those Australtens can just think ahead a little bit, we'll be there next month, buy yourself a rescue helicopter, get some anti-venom, get some rescue gear. Just keep – if you don't use it, you can return all of it, but it could save our lives.
I like the idea of our rental car being so small that it literally is afraid of snakes. Like it's turned into in my mind like a Pixar,
quaking, quivering.
like a Pixar style animated car called Yaris McGee, voiced by Owen Wilson, and it starts off the movie real scared of snakes, and then it learns to overcome its fear. Of the outback. What I'm really trying to say here, and I mean this, is do let us know about things. Like if you know Australia, if you are from Australia, or if you've traveled there, and you have useful advice, we are really all ears because I still want to do this, but I don't want us to die, and I just don't want us to be inconvenienced to a degree that's ludicrous. Like. In order, I don't want us to be inconvenienced to a degree that the only person who can save us is Ludacris, the handsome young stranger. Mm-hmm. Now that would be cool. He just comes through and like pays for all of our tab at the Pink Panther pub in Larimer. No, I don't want us to get like run out of gas in the middle of nowhere. Not even because I think we're going to die, but because I think it's going to really screw up our schedule of posting the show. And like the show is what do they say on that newscast for kids? V important. The newscast is – or excuse me, the posting of the shows are V important that week because, of course, it is our 1 week a year where we actively fundraise on the air. And, like, if we don't raise money that week during the TV telethon, not only are we not going back to Australia, we're not going anywhere with the show because the show will be canceled. So, point being, I want us to be really – I want us to actually really have a good plan. I do want to hear from the listeners about things that we should be worried about so that we can make a good, solid plan so we have fun, so it's an adventure, but so we don't end up trapped somewhere deciding who gets to eat who. Because my meat, even though I stopped drinking a while ago, I feel like my meat is very still soaked through with vodka, and I don't think I'd be good eating. I want that on the record, Andrew, in case things get weird later.
Okay. Yeah, like they're not getting weird now. I haven't even thought about the implications. Forget about even being able to listen to the Mariners game. What's the baseball schedule like that week? We didn't think this out at all.
Will the Mariners be 44-1?
I assume I can only assume. Possible. Speaking of, I'm looking forward to a day game today. Starts at 1:00, so
yes, exciting. Get that weekend rolling early.
Yeah, yep. All right. I miss baseball. This is how crazy I am. We do need to take a break, and so I'll just say this: the Mariners on their little roll. Then they had to take a break for Wednesday for traveling. Or no, I'm sorry, they were going to travel on Thursday, and I was like, oh. I can't watch baseball today. Then Thursday's game gets postponed. I honestly have been like, when are you bringing the Mariners back? It's only been 2 days. I am insane for this stupid team right now.
Well, of course you are, because they're off to the best start in the history of the franchise, which everyone knows is not sustainable because this is not the movie Major League. Exactly. They do not have a rendering of their capricious owner, which they will slowly denude over the course of the season. We do not. This is not the world we live in, and yet it's very, very fun to see them win games and to just have these kind of weird storylines emerge. I mean, I'm with you because, yeah, you're right. They were traveling for a day, and I was like, oh, okay. And then there was a postponement, and I was like, wow, that's really there's a baseball-shaped hole in my heart right now. Mm-hmm. Now, they are going to come back to Earth, and it's going to be soon, and it's like everyone's waiting for the other cleat to drop. But mm-hmm. that's a freebie, Ryan Divish, if you want to use that. Or anybody out there, Danny, Dave, Moore, anyone, that's, go for it. But in the meantime, boy, is it fun! And I'll be keeping one eye on it from here in Portland too. I am sure, Andrew, that let me put it this way: if by some weird thing the Mariners have not totally regressed to the mean by the end of May, I am figuring out a way for us to be listening to it in the Outback because the Mike Zunino miracle stands mm-hmm. in my mind as one of the top five sports moments in my life. In fact, maybe top 10 life moments. And and I do not want us to miss a chance for something like that to happen in the middle of nowhere as we fight off snakes.
Did we end up going to the playoffs that year with the Miracle on Dirt? No, I don't think so. Huh?
Andrew, no. We haven't been to the playoffs. We have the longest playoff drought of. Oh, you were messing with me.
I'm just teasing. I've never seen the Mariners in the playoffs since I've been watching baseball.
And so. You won't for a while.
But, I don't even know. I know that theoretically and intellectually something called playoffs exists, but I have zero proof of it.
The parallels between this Mariners season and our trip through the Outback are so striking. They're both cursed journeys.
Which and we're both gonna get injured by Diamondbacks.
Whoa! Ding, ding, ding! If I had my bell, ding, ding. I'd be dinging it. There you go. That was a pretty solid spoof, my friend. All right, let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll tell you about the decline of the buffet restaurant in America, and the incline of adult ball pits, and then we've got some music for your weekend too. So stay with us. Imagine listening to this in a Yaris dodging snakes.
Just speeding through the Outback. We got to watch all the Australian movies we can, by the way. I'm thinking of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I still Strictly Ballroom. We have a lot of catching up to do.
Rewatch the Johnny Depp, Amber Heard dog video.
Right. I think we got that one memorized. By the way, the reason I'm playing this is jazz music.
Yeah,
this is related to the newsletter too. In this week's newsletter, which will be going out later on this afternoon, in the Hey Dummies video, you answered a listener question about music you listen to when you're trying to focus, and I realize this might be an unpopular choice, but for me, it's this record called Money Jungle, which is technically a Duke Ellington record, but it's also got Charles Mingus and Max Roach on it.
Wow.
And at some point, I just fell in love with this record. And then I remember, especially at KCRW, but I think predating that too, when I was on deadline and I was sitting in, you know, a newsroom somewhere and I needed to block out all the noise and block out the haters, I would just put on my headphones and listen to Money Jungle. So you would think, though, because I listened to Money Jungle during some very, very stressful times, I was concerned. I actually even had this thought at the time, will Money Jungle be ruined for me because it'll always remind me of being on deadline and super stressed out and thinking this isn't going to get done in time. But no, I was writing the newsletter today and your video reminded me of Money Jungle and I went back and I still love this. It's so good.
Okay, I really liked what you were playing and it gives me hope because – I consider myself to be quite the dilettante when it comes to being a jazz man. And, you know, I kind of, and in fact, I specifically mentioned Oscar Peterson in that Hey Dummies video because I really like Oscar Peterson Trio and the other, you know, types of jazz, I guess you would say music that come up on that Pandora algorithm. But I feel like that's real kind of like entry level jazz. It's not very challenging. It's very, you know, melodic and follows the kind of typical rules of music. So I think of what you just played as, you know, like maybe like if Charles, if the Oscar Peterson Trio is 101, that's maybe like 102 or 202. Mm-hmm. And I was enjoying it. So that kind of, maybe I'm progressing a little bit. I'm also wondering, Andrew, if for next year's TBTL-a-thon, if maybe we should do something where we try to, like, I don't know, float down the Amazon River and we call it TBTL-a-thon 11 Money Jungle.
That would be kind of great. I thought you were going to say, how about for next year's TBTL-a-thon, we start a jazz quintet and we just
see if we can
make it to the top of the pops.
Oh, that would be that's so great. H. John Benjamin style.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, that'd right.
Be, yeah. That would be perfect. No, I liked that a lot. Actually, that was
check
that
was it out.
Cool.
Yeah, listen to it on maybe on an airplane or just the next time you're kind of looking for it. Now, I realize though this might not be good concentration music. That was the real focus, is like music to listen to when you're trying to get work done. You're trying to focus and you can't have lyrics and. You know, like hip hop can be very distracting if you're trying to write because the lyrics are so forefront. This is not smooth, so I don't know if this is going to work for everybody because there's a lot going on certainly in especially that first song, which is called Money Jungle. So I don't know if that would work for you, but honestly, Luke, I sort of feel like check out this stuff. Also, I think I told you Kind of Blue, which is like the most accessible kind of. You know, jazz record of this era and of this type. It's still my number. It's like the Sgt. Pepper of jazz, which I just realized that's a pretty outdated reference too. But that's like my go-to airplane album. Like just floating in the sky and listening to Kind of Blue is quite an experience for me that you might enjoy as well.
I wanted to add one thing to the Hey Dummies video that I did this week. First of all, I know yesterday we just talked a lot about like being too self-critical of the show at some point becomes annoying to listeners potentially. So I'm on the edge of doing that. But like I felt lame about the video because one, I made it at 5:30 in the morning on the street. I was heavily distracted. I didn't feel like I gave a very thorough answer. And also I was dressed like Steve Zissou, which I didn't really fully realize until I saw myself in the video. But one of the things that, without giving too much away, was someone asking me about, or asking us really about like music to be productive to. And I left one off the list. And Andrew, I am not saying this for effect. I have been listening to Yanni lately. Like, Yanni, not Laurel, Yanni. And not ironically, I actually talked about this on Livewire. I think the episode is going to air like in a week or two. But it's absolutely true. On the airplane yesterday, I was listening to Yanni live at the Acropolis, and like without totally derailing the show here with this, basically what happened was I was telling you about that Studio 360 story that was amazing that I highly recommend everybody check out about basically the role that the Public Television Pledge Drive's concert specials have played in the, elevating the careers of people like Yanni, John Tesh, the people with Riverdance, etc., and how Yanni and his then wife, for the actor from Dynasty, Linda Evans, had basically mortgaged their, you know, everything to create this concert film, Yanni Live at the Acropolis, when he wasn't really that famous yet. And they created it to try to get it on public television, and it worked fabulously. So anyway, they're playing that Yanni music at times during this radio piece, and they had the good sense to not come in and opine on Yanni, but I felt the subtext was, Yanni is, you know, it's not the coolest music to listen to. But as I was listening to snippets of it in that radio piece, I was like, no, actually, this is kind of working for me, like Santorini and other such hits off of the Live at the Acropolis album. So I downloaded it. And I was listening to it on the plane yesterday. It is oddly working for me of late because it doesn't have lyrics. And that's something I mentioned in the Hey Dummies video. Like, for me, if I'm trying to be productive, like, it can't, the lyrics have to be so far in the background they almost don't exist, or they have to literally not exist. Like, it has to be instrumental. And this Yanni stuff is like, doesn't have any words, but it's sort of triumphant at times, and it's sort of plaintive at times. It's grandiose. It's like a movie soundtrack to a movie that never existed. And I'm kind of digging it. And I know that it seems like I'm trying to be post ironic with it, but I'm really not. It's just kind of working for me.
I believe that. I wonder what Yanni is like if he's I wonder what Yanni's like. I remember there was a documentary called Weedle's Groove. You're probably familiar with Weedle's
Yes.
Groove, about the Seattle, like the historic funk scene in Seattle, which I didn't know existed before this, and how there was, you know, and part of that scene, if you can believe it or not, in the 1970s was Kenny G. And Kenny G Yep. is interviewed in this, and he has a good kind of, I think, perspective on his music and his career. And he knows that he's kind of blowing some corny shit, as the jazz cats might say. I don't think they'd actually say that, though. But
out of sight,
I just
Daddy-O, you was blowing that corny shit.
I would love to name today's show Blow That Corny Shit, Daddy-O, but I don't want to put the S word in the show title. Anyway, I really liked his perspective. I wonder if Yanni is similar when it comes to kind of self-realization.
I would guess not, but you
really?
Know who does? I mean, based on nothing, like I don't have that's just my gut on it, but you know who did seem, I keep referencing the story, everyone should just go listen to it, but you know who did seem really self-aware in this way that kind of made me feel bad about how much we've kind of crapped on him on this show, is one John Tesh, the auteur mm-hmm. behind Round Ball Rock, the NBC mm-hmm. NBA theme. Like, John Tesh is also in the piece, and he's totally gets it. Like, maybe not, like, I mean, he says some, like, oddly profound things. And again, I'm sorry, me paraphrasing is not nearly as good as just listening to the story. But, you know, he talks about basically he saw Yanni do this thing, and he's working in Entertainment Tonight, and his real love is music. And one, he tells a story about his band played a Nordstrom opening, literally, like, can you imagine walking into a Nordstrom, presumably in, like, you know, mm-hmm. Pasadena or something, and there's like music playing, it's a live band, and it's John Tesh, it's the guy from Entertainment Tonight, is just playing at a Nordstrom. You know, assuming that story is not made up, that's kind of crazy to me. Because he was already famous, but for something different. And then he saw this Yanni thing, and he realized, like, oh, this is how you do it. And so he mortgaged his house. And I was also surprised, the mortgage, he was only able to mortgage his house to the tune of about $500,000, which I was like, John Tesh should be living in a nicer house, you know, circa whenever that would be, 1995 or something, when he's at the height of his like, his finances of doing Entertainment Tonight seemed surprisingly normal to me. Which, again, I don't know why I zero in on that part of the story. But then he starts talking about later about people kind of making fun of his music. And he says, if I remember right, something to the effect of, like, he's like, I get it. He goes, something to the effect of, like, he goes, my whole, just the fact that this is something I get to do is such a joke to me. Like, it's so crazy that there's nothing anyone can say about it that I haven't thought myself,
mm-hmm.
you know? And he's not saying it defensively. He's like, it just seems like John Tesh is just living his best 6'7" intelligence for your life. Life. And
I'm not handling this well. I don't feel competent. I'm depressed.
I'm slouching. It's like that whole kind of like faux casualness he has when he does his intelligence for your life show. It all feeds into this idea I have of like John Tesh just being kind of like an insufferable smarm. But I kind of think that it's because he's just Teflon at this point. Like, it's – I'm not doing a good job describing it, but I got done listening to that piece and I thought, I am really feeling it for John Tesh as an individual.
I heard a In the Wild – was I listening to Como? Was I listening to Kixie? I don't know what I was listening to, but I heard a real-life intelligence for your health with Connie Selica last week. Do you know that Connie
that
Selica
would be-
–
Yeah, that's John Tesh's wife.
Oh, they're married.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh. That makes sense. Wow, I hadn't thought of Connie Selleck in a really long time.
We're actually rolling out a new segment on this show called Intelligence for Your Wife, and that's going to be where Carrie talks about jazz music.
I hate myself for laughing at that, but I can't help it.
Could you, sir, because I do think you have all of your audio cables, could you cue up our razzling, dazzling music so we can thank the dazzling donors?
On your mark. Get set.
Get set.
Now ready.
Ready.
Go. Everybody rattle, dazzle. Everybody rattle, dazzle. Everybody.
All right, even though many of the listeners of the show are giving us the gift of information regarding how bad the idea of Australia is, some of the listeners are giving an even more important gift, which is money, on a monthly basis, and not an insignificant amount of it.
Can I tell you, like, I know that probably the Dazzling Donor segment is not the time for me to interject with old Dilbert cartoons that I remember from my youth.
Is there ever a bad time for that?
Maybe it is. I don't know. But there was a time when I loved Dilbert, when Dilbert was newer, and we didn't
me
know
too.
What a wackadoo Scott Adams was. And I was actually working in an office environment for part of this time, too, as like a high schooler working for my dad. And I remember there was a cartoon. I mean, this slayed me. The boss with the pointy hair is giving a presentation to his workers. He says, "For a long time, we told you guys that employees were our most important asset. We were wrong. Turns out money is our most important asset."
That's a good joke.
And I remember being like 15 years old and being like, this guy's got it. This guy's got it. I think of that comic strip like once a week to this day.
I also loved Dilbert. I mean, the part of it is that I was a power user of cartoons or of comics, I guess you would call it. And so when a new one came on the scene, because I was reading so many lame comics, like, mm-hmm. I mean, no offense, but like Mary Worth or Prince Valiant or like Apartment 3G. Like, and so it's weird that I never became a big graphic novel person or like, you know, a person who was really into comics, like, you know, reading them or following them as an adult, because I was really into them as a kid. But they're so, most of them are so stale that, like, when something like, I remember when, well, The Far Side, of course, was a revelation. And I think, unless there's something we don't know about Gary Larson, I assume that The Far Side is still pretty great. And then Dilbert also blew my mind.
Yeah. Gary Larson, God. Talk about a career where, and maybe, you know, I wonder if I have a somewhat distorted idea of how huge The Far Side was in the 80s. I don't know. In my family, it was huge. I had the page-a-day calendar. I was actually looking to buy, I wanted to see, are they still creating a page-a-day calendar for Far Side just using old comics? They are not, and there's one selling for like hundreds of dollars from the 90s on eBay. Gary Larson seemed like he was on top of his game and really helped usher in a whole new era of weird one-panel comics. And then he's just like, I'm done. I'm going to release my last cartoon and I'm going to be done. And then I'm just going to disappear into the woods of, I don't know, Greater Seattle somewhere. Where is he? He's somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, right? Is he?
Yeah, he was from Tacoma as a kid. And maybe it was my sense of Gary Larson was overemphasized growing up in the Northwest, because it was like those Far Side books and, like you said, you know, sort of cartoon or comic per day calendars. There was so much Far Side everything where I grew up. And it's probably because of the region. But you were in Ohio seeing the same stuff. I think it spoke to a certain sense of humor in a way that that you know, wasn't happening. Well, you know what? Honestly, it was probably happening in the New Yorker, and I certainly didn't know about it.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
I think it's why I really like New Yorker cartoons. You know, generally speaking, it's the exact same kind of droll humor. But really, what I was just thinking as we're talking about it, and I think, you know, this show. And by the way, thank you to the Dazzling Donors. I think that wraps up that message.
Yeah.
This show, we're
good. Thanks for the money.
This
dudes.
Show really serves as a place for me to madman ideas for TV stories. I wonder if CBS would let me do a profile of Gary Larson. Like, where's the guy who drew The Far Side? He's also not that old. He was born in 1950, I'm seeing here on the internet. So I'm sure he's presumably still hale and hearty and living somewhere in the Northwest. Like, he's an enigmatic figure. And it's kind of interesting because it really was like – that was my sense of humor. I felt like what I thought was funny was being reflected back to me in those Far Side cartoons, like in a way that a lot of other stuff wasn't. And it was, you know, it was like a big deal to me, like people who really bonded with Star Trek or any kind of pop culture thing that they just feel like Doctor Who, that it's just like, oh, this is something that works for me. That was me with the Far Side.
Me too, big time. We had that book, The Prehistory of the Far Side, that told all these hilarious behind-the-scenes stories. And if you got to do that, I mean, I assume that he doesn't do interviews. I don't know, maybe nobody's asked in a while, but like, I think of him as like the J.D. Salinger of comic strips. Like, that would be, I would tune into, I'd wake up for that on a Sunday.
Right? Like, yeah. could I finally get you to watch my television stories, Daddy?
Perfect.
On your mark. On your mark. Get set.
Now and ready. Resetting in three, two, and one of the most important gifts you can give this show is money. And we have a couple people. Secret tools of the dazzling donor. And it's just like a debit card they use to scrape up the money when no one's looking at them. That is such an obscure Far Side reference, and I apologize. You know that card. You know that one, right?
No, I'm racking my brain. What is that one?
It was like secret tools. It was basically like secret tools of, I'm going to say, the crow. It wasn't a crow. I don't think crows featured prominently in his work. But the joke was there was like a really flat piece of roadkill, and there was some like
animals sitting around.
Yeah, and it was a spatula. And then when no one's like, when there are no cars around, they break out a spatula to get the roadkill off
right.
the ground.
Okay, good. I'm so glad that I was able to remember that, because I got to say, I was a little bummed. Like, I feel like I knew every Far Side so well. I remember me and Genevieve and our friend Uncle Paulie used to sit around my apartment in Concord, New Hampshire, circa 2002, flipping through Far Sides, and we'd play a game where one person would describe the what's going on in the scene, and we'd have to say exactly what the caption is, or oh my God. You could flip it and reverse it. And we knew them all. We knew them all.
Dude, we are doing this on the road trip in Australia.
Yes, that's a good car game. You're right. I got to go buy. Can I go expense some Far Side books?
Yes, you can. As not your direct supervisor, I authorize this. And then we can also write in the margins of the Far Side books our last will and testament. It'd be kind of a whole, you know,
right.
Ernest Shackleton type deal.
It'll where be we're perfect. Just
we're narrating what's happened to us and how things have gone so wrong in the margins of like the cartoon panel where it's like the school for the gifted and the kids trying to push on the door.
Right. I think my dad has that mug.
All right. In three, two, and let's thank Mark Nelson from Durham, North Carolina. He's a dazzling donor today. Mark says, I operate a nonprofit called Reading with Conviction, which sends books to prison libraries, over 13,000 in the last 10 years. Mark, have you sent any Far Side books? Could really brighten someone's day. Believe it or not, the hardest part of this is not raising the money or buying the books. It's making contact with prisons willing to take books. Well, there is a whole kind of cinematic history behind like books and cakes with a giant file in them. So I don't know if that's working against Mark's interests here. But Mark says, if any of the tens or a close friend or family member works in a prison and can facilitate the process of accepting books for either pleasure reading or educational purposes, please contact me directly. And here is Mark's email address. It's Mark, M-A-R-K, at Nelson, which is N-E-L-S-O-N, dot U-S. Or use the contact page at readingwithconviction.org. I provide general reading material with absolutely zero strings attached. Thanks for helping me get the word out. That is such a cool project, and also very interesting that the challenge would be getting prisons to actually get back at you about the free books you're trying to send them.
Can I tell – I actually did honest to God quasi-reporting on this last week. Because – so Mark sent this donor message in months ago, I presume. But this is actually in the news here in Washington State. Last week, there was a story about how there's another program, another nonprofit organization similar to the one that Mark works at. And they said that they noticed their books started getting rejected a lot from Washington State prisons. Just all of a sudden, they weren't going through. And they couldn't figure it out, and they went digging into the DOC, the Department of Corrections website, and they found something quietly posted by Washington State DOC saying that the state prisons were going to stop accepting outside used books out of fear of contraband. And the woman I was talking with at another organization was saying that she's very dubious of that, and you've seen this try to happen in other states too, where there may be ulterior motives to keeping prisoners, you know, from accessing information. And it's a, I think it's a really terrible story, and they're encouraging people to also write to their lawmakers here in the state to try to get this at least investigated and hopefully overturned, this ban on these, essentially what these organizations do.
Man, that's, yeah, like, whatever. I don't need to opine on prison policy during the dazzling donor thank you messages, but that sounds like a pretty bad idea to me. And it sounds like what listener Mark's doing is a pretty awesome idea. So
yeah,
go to readingwithconviction.org if you can help out in any way. I've asked this before. I wonder if we have any currently incarcerated listeners. I feel like that might be hard to pull off depending on the rules as far as, you know, internet access and phone access. But it'd be kind of interesting to find out if we have,
yeah,
if you're a listener and you're incarcerated and you can reach out to us, do so. When we did the night show on the radio, when this show was actually on the radio, we had a lot of listeners in prison. We would hear from many of them frequently.
It's like right now, if we have any prisoners who are listeners, they're prisoners who feel so guilty about their crimes that they feel like they need to add more punishment. Like the state,
yes,
didn't punish us enough. Give me a podcast of two chuckleheads talking for 3 hours, reciting Far Side jokes from their youth.
Yeah. This is actually a Geneva Convention human rights violation, being forced to listen to this show while incarcerated.
Can I set you up with some more dazzling donor music here?
Yes, sir. Never
Let's
get tired of the songs.
On your mark. Get set.
Get set.
Now ready.
Ready.
Go.
Everybody rattle, dazzle.
We're also being dazzled by the donation of Scott Gakey from Seattle, Washington. Here's what Scott says. My dad, Dave Gakey, passed away a couple of months ago, and I wanted to share a little bit of him through today's show pick. First of all, sorry, Scott.
That's
really sad to hear, man. He was a lover of nature and spent his life working to preserve it in the National Fish and Wildlife Service. I feel you can really feel his appreciation for the natural world in his photos. We are currently in the process of sorting through the thousands that he shot over his career and finding a home for them on the internet where people can also share in them. And then he included a bunch of these photos that his dad took that are amazing. You sent them to me, Andrew. They're pretty incredible.
Yeah, they're beautiful, aren't they? Yeah, all kinds of. I mean, big beasts to small birds, which is also the name of my book. I want to use the one today because it's the highest definition one we have, and it's just incredible, of this hummingbird. So you won't see it in your podcatcher, but if you go to tbtl.net, you can check out some of his dad's work.
Also, the people who listen to this show and the people they're related to are really doing God's work. You got listener Mark with the sending books to people who are in prison. You got listener Scott, whose dad is working for the Fish and Wildlife Service and out there taking pictures and bringing everybody in on the experience. There's just some good eggs we have out there in the listening audience, as opposed to bad eggs on Twitter, which are just made up accounts that are there to torture me.
Right.
Scott adds, also thanks to everybody who followed us at Lodgepole Distilling on Instagram. Oh, right, because Scott is the person behind Lodgepole Distilling. And other social media after last year's message. We must have referenced that during last year's read. We have not been too active of late due to some personal events. See earlier in the message. But keep your eye on us, though. Some big things are happening in the next few months, and we are back to posting pictures of our delightful animals in the meantime. So that's the message from listener Scott, another dazzling donor. Thank you, Scott, so much again. Really sorry for your loss. And everybody go look at the picture that we're going to put up that Scott's dad took. To just honor him and remember him a little bit. So thanks again, Mark and Scott. We absolutely could not do this show without you.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
All right, our top story, Andrew, you sent me this this morning, and I read, let me just tell you this, it was all I could eat when it came to the reading of this story. I could not consume enough of this story. It's from Vox. It's written by someone named Caitlin Tiffany. It's titled, When Did America's Heart Turn Cold on Buffet Chains? And it is, as you said in your message to me, chock full of dazzling details about the buffet restaurant industry in America, which is basically kind of in free fall right now, with the exception of Golden Corral. The writer talks about how growing up, she was a huge fan of a place called Ponderosa Steakhouse, which was big in, I don't know how to say this word. I give New York State credit. New York State really gives Washington State a run for its money in terms of towns that are probably named for a local tribe that you have a 0% chance of pronouncing correctly if you are a white person who just showed up. And this is one of those. Canandaigua? Canandaigua, New York?
Canandaigua? Canandaigua?
That's where the writer of this piece grew up, apparently, and would go to these Ponderosa Steakhouse. And she writes that she loved it because she would get to, as a kid, select her own food, carry her own food, and serve her own ice cream. And I will tell you that the – and it wasn't really that often, but the few times that I was able to go to a buffet-style restaurant as a kid, it was all about that ice cream to me. But also, I had never thought of it, all about the freedom as a kid of actually being able to pick what you were going to eat, to just walk around and be like, I want that. I will have that. It's a very exciting feeling as a kid. So she writes about that, but then she goes on to talk about how this Ponderosa Steakhouse chain, which was founded by one of the guys from Bonanza, Dan Blocker, who played Hoss, which is kind of its whole. I mean, that's the perfect restaurant for Dan Blocker to open, because Hoss was this, you know, big old guy, who presumably, you know, could really put it away out there. Hop Singh fixing up the food on Bonanza, and Hoss eating it down. So anyway, she writes about how basically these Ponderosa restaurants, at one point there was 305 of them, and then this other sister buffet called Bonanza's. Now they're down to 75 locations total. And a lot of them are not even in the U.S. And then she goes on to talk about all these other companies that basically – here's a dazzling detail for you, Andrew, that I'm sure you already noticed. This company, Ovation Brands, which runs Old Country Buffet, filed for bankruptcy three times, which people jokingly refer to as Chapter 33.
Yes. Chapter 11 three times in a row is Chapter 33.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
She goes on to just kind of to detail the fact that these buffets are really kind of going out of business at a pretty rapid rate. Also, there's just so many references to restaurant chains that sound like they would have been started by Ron Donald. It talks a lot about soup plantation.
Yeah,
there's
a place called Super
Salad.
Wait, Super Salad? That's the Ron. No,
Super Crackers
is yeah, right, yeah. Right. Super Crackers, yeah. Oh, my God. Super Crackers. That is a great joke in and of itself. That show, man, want to talk about too beautiful to live. But, yeah, a lot of soup-based buffets, which don't sound good to me. By the way, I encourage you to continue with this story, but if I can interject here for a second. This caught my eye because I've been in very much a Old Country Buffet mood lately. I haven't been since I was a child. I think part of it might have to do with the fact of our new recording schedule. I wake up early. I'm drowsy. I'm groggy. I'm foggy. I drink coffee during the show. That coffee, as I've tried to explain before on the show, ends up making me like really like high strung and starving by the time the show is done. So I'm in the mood to really be gluttonous even more than usual, I think. And like yesterday, I drove up to Edmonds and had an Arby's. Remember that sandwich I was talking about the other day that I had to I had to unlock my jaw to eat?
Yes.
I ordered it again yesterday.
I saw on Twitter you're like the Arby's killer. There's just like a map of the Arby's that have gone out of business. Right. It looked like you had like a weird list of Arby's that you were taking out.
It's like you see the blue dot of where I live in the middle of the map, and then just all of the dead Arby's around me. I drive all the way up to Edmonds. Anyway, I have done something recently on Google Maps looking for old country buffets. The last time I went to a buffet was, I'm going to say, about 6 months ago, but it was it's Bluefin. Is that what the place is called at the mall?
Yes.
Northgate Mall. It's like it's an Asian, mostly kind of seafood-based buffet, although they have plenty of non-seafood stuff. And I'm not huge on seafood or fish as it is. I really don't trust it in a buffet setting. So I think I mostly just went there and ate a bunch of chicken wings, but I was in the mood for it. But lately I've been thinking about I just want to pile up a plate with stuffing and chicken wings and I don't know, maybe some spaghetti, as the writer of this article points out. You know, I think it was her, or maybe it was somebody she was interviewing who was saying, I like the option of just putting together weird meal combinations.
You know who it was? It was a food safety specialist. It was a professor who studies, because that's one of the things we'll get to in a minute here, is the sort of food handling implications of a place that has massive rows of food that's mostly kept at room temperature is real bad. But she happens to find this one food safety expert who regularly eats at these buffet restaurants.
Yes. And who will admit, she says, you won't find a lot of us. She's like, I go to these things all the time. Usually those of us in this field avoid these places, but not me, which I just found to be so damn charming. I mean, just what a great get for this article. But anyway, so I kept on thinking one of these days I'm just going to make the drive after TBTL to Old Country Buffet. Well, I couldn't find anywhere even remotely near me. And after reading this, man, the detailing of how food can go so wrong when it's sitting out here. And it just generally gave me a vibe of the kind of things that are probably going on. This is my own imagination in a place like this, as far as food prep is concerned and the way food is handled. This really turned my stomach.
I have to say that Caitlin Tiffany, this is such a well-written piece. She sort of broaches what you're talking about high up in the piece. She says, I have to say, this is the first time in my career in which I have felt a real temptation to withhold information from readers in hopes of helping them lead a less informed but ultimately more enjoyable life.
Yes.
But if you're an adult and you can make your own choices, you may wish you were a child at Ponderosa who can make her own choices, but this is not the case. You should know up front that this is not going to be fun, and I'm sorry. That's how she launches into all of the reasons that these buffets seem to be going out of business. The first one isn't so much gross as just kind of monetary, and it's what I've always wondered about, which is, what are the economics of these places? How can you have that much food, however cheaply the food is made? How can you have that much food out and on offer and people are just allowed to have as much of it as they want? How is that? You would think it would need to be $100 a person for that to be a business model that worked. And she goes in to talk about all of these interesting little things, there's, buffet line size plates that are made by companies specifically to make it harder for you to get a bunch of food on your plate.
More trips.
They have lots of very heavily carb-laden sides, which always get me. In the rare occasion I go to a buffet, Andrew, I mean, really what I want to eat are King's Hawaiian-style rolls with a shitload of butter on them. That for me, if you find me when I go leaving Las Vegas on it, you're going to find me in a hotel room with just 40 bags of King's Hawaiian rolls, a toaster, and just a tub of butter. And Elizabeth Shue, oddly, I don't know how I got her to come, but I did.
Elizabeth Shue pouring bread rolls all over herself.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, so she basically writes about how actually thin the profit margins are for these buffet restaurants, and how they're kind of this whole, they're trying to really keep you away from the carving station. They're trying to keep you away from the meats because that's what's costing them the most money. And interestingly enough, little kind of subtle things that some restaurants have done where they don't call it all you can eat. They call it all you care to eat because they want you to have it somewhere in your mind that it's not a competition. You're not winning a free t-shirt if you literally eat all the food you can physically eat. They want you to kind of identify that this is the amount of food you want to eat. They also talk about the 2-pound rule, the fact that most humans just can't eat more than 2 pounds of food. So that's one of the things that these restaurants would factor in, which I find kind of incredible. There was a couple in Utah that was low carbing that was asked to leave after they made 12 trips to the carving station.
Well, that's infuriating. That's just downright infuriating. You're entering a contract. Like, you know that there are other people who are eating. I actually found the economics of this more surprising than you'd think. As a kid, you might think, how can they afford this? I'm going to eat so much. But, you know, my thing is, or my theory was, they're serving crappy food. They're generally overcharging for it. They, you know, they know that, yeah, the occasional person is going to come through and really try to test the limits of this thing. But for the most part, they've probably got it dialed in pretty well, knowing that on average or overall, people are not actually eating as much as what they're paying for when you kind of like do the numbers on that. But apparently I'm wrong. Apparently they are dealing with some margin issues, as you say.
Well, one of the things that she mentioned in this piece also is that, you know, the typical buffet customer is, as she puts it, value and price conscious. And that kind of squares with my experience. It's like, you know, like honestly, and this is going to sound super coastal elitist of me, but, you know, like when I really want to have a good meal, I am not thinking what are the most shrimp I can get into my face for under $11. That's just not how my brain works. And if that, I'm not saying anything about people that go to buffet restaurants, but like you're getting a bunch of people who are probably pretty price sensitive. So you can't just like, in fact, you know, Addie and I, when we were in Portland, I'm sorry, when we were in Washington, D.C., the Portland of the East, we went by where she lives. We went to this kind of cool, like, I don't know what you'd call it, food market area that had all these restaurants and stuff. And next to it was this other restaurant that we had seen people lining up for the day before. And because we're sheeple, we were like, wow, there must be something going on there. And we went and sat down in the restaurant and found out that they have this like extremely extravagant breakfast brunch that was like $70 a person. But it was like all you could eat and drink. And so, of course, the drinking side of it was really lost on me and mostly lost on Addie. So we ended up not eating there. But I was like, you know, that seems expensive, but if they're going to let you eat, and I'm assuming they used really high quality items, like that's really more like what I think it should cost to let someone eat all of what they want. And so anyway, with these buffets, a lot of them, they can't charge you $70 because no one would go to them. So they've got this tug of war going of trying to keep the price seemingly low because the people that are coming there partially because the price is low. And by the way, Andrew, jump in at any time. I'm just kind of on a stemwinder with this.
Well, while we're on the price point thing, I was also surprised by one other thing that the writer didn't seem surprised by, which is that the recession especially hurt these places. And the reason I'm surprised by that is because of everything that you just said, that it seems like in a recession, things that appeal to the pocketbook, like I can get a whole bunch of food for a very low cost, I would think that those businesses would thrive. You would think it would be more like the high-end kind of places that might suffer the most in a recession.
Well, she was saying the food cost goes up. Mm. So that was really – and I will say this, you know, being related to somebody – actually now two people who own restaurants, because my sister, of course, here in Portland has Pollo Bravo with my brother-in-law, Josh. And then my cousin, Ruthie, is part of a group of people who opened a restaurant on Capitol Hill in Seattle called Dacha Diner. And it just got the most rapturous review in the Seattle Times, Andrew. I was just proud. I was cavelling. Like Bethany Jean Clement, who I think
I was about to ask, was it my girl? She is such a great writer. That is awesome. I
really
am such a fan of hers.
And you should read this. Look up the review of Dacha Diner in the Seattle Times. It made me like go, forget the fact that it's my cousin who opened the place. I'm like, I need to go there and eat everything on the menu, including all the meats, which as I've established is not really my jam these days. Anyway, one thing I know from being related to people in the restaurant industry is that food cost is really like make or break. Like if you have to throw out a bunch of food, or if the cost of something goes up and you can't just make every entree more, it's really, really a challenge from a business perspective. And I also think, and this is me just speculating, Andrew, talking about the recession being bad for these buffet places, I also have a feeling that even though price point is important to a lot of the customers of, say, Golden Corral or whatever, I also think that it is considered a luxury. And this is totally my guess. But I'm just thinking, remember how I grew up? There was a place in Eureka, California called the Royal Fork, which I don't know if that was a if that predated King's Table or if it became a King's Table. But we, for some brief amount of time, had something called the Royal Fork. And I remember, like, as a little
like
kid.
British slang for like copulation or something.
I remember it being the treat of all treats to go to the Royal Fork. And if my mom and dad would have done a little less Royal Forking, we would have had more money for going to the Royal Fork. It's the great irony of this whole situation. Thank you. Thank you very much. But so I wonder if for the recession hit these places hard, because even though the price seems reasonably affordable, it probably hit a lot of people were like so kind of financially strapped that even going to Golden Corral, that was a treat that was now off the list. I wondered. That's just my unscientific theory. Now, she also she spends a good amount of time talking about the health implications of this food. Not so much the like cholesterol or BMI, but rather just the something called fried rice syndrome, which this was news to me. It's basically a food, kind of a food poisoning that it's called Bacillus cereus. And it is, she describes it as gram-positive, rod-shaped, aerobic, facultatively anaerobic, motile, beta, hemolytic bacterium, which can survive as a spore being boiled and fried. And then comes out the other side ready to germinate and grow when left at room temperature. So this is a bad thing in your food that can survive being boiled and fried. So that sounds dangerous.
Yeah. And, you know, she mentioned something that I learned when I got my food handling permit recently, which I got for because I was supposed to volunteer in the kitchen at the Eagles, which I never did. But it's good to have this thing. And the thing you do learn about is this thing called the danger zone. You got to keep food cold below 41 degrees or hot above 135. But if you just kind of like make a big thing of food and you just let it sit out, and it's going to, you know, languish somewhere in that danger zone between 41 and 135, that's when these bacteria and all kinds of things start to grow in there, which is really bad for you. And she also mentions, not in the same graph, but some guy who ran one of these places did an AMA on Reddit and was talking about behind the scenes stuff and said, yes, like we take the leftover food and we, you know, use it to make soups and whatnot and reserve it, which in a kitchen doesn't bother me because you're assuming that people are keeping their food in the kitchen. They're handling it correctly. They're keeping it out of the danger zone, et cetera, et cetera. But this seems to imply that, like, if there's some food, I mean, maybe I'm just reading too much into it, but I took that to mean if there's a bunch of food left over that has already been exposed to the public, people like scooping things out, kids sneezing, the food just being under heat lamps for a long time.
People pawing at it.
Yes.
Like,
is that food going back in the kitchen?
Do I want this? Yeah.
Is that going back in the kitchen and going into soup? Like, that's terrible.
And casseroles, they mentioned in the piece.
Like, and casseroles, yeah.
Like, I mean, how else would it work? It's like you probably go out there at the end of the night and whatever hasn't been consumed that's been out under the heat lamps or sitting out, you know, if it's usable, if it can be integrated into another food product, you go for it. She also talks in the piece about cantaloupe being extremely dangerous. So cantaloupe, I would have never known this, but cantaloupe basically like is you get E. coli going in cantaloupe, and she describes the skin of a cantaloupe as basically a big mesh net designed to specially hold in bacteria. And that if you cut a cantaloupe and there's E. coli in the cantaloupe, every time you cut it, you're spreading the E. coli around. And then if you put it out at room temperature, it blooms. Apparently, if you put it in the refrigerator, there's a chance that it kind of arrests the growth. But if you put cantaloupe out room temperature and it's got problems, those problems will multiply rapidly. Which the good news is, it would never occur to me in a trillion years to eat cantaloupe at a buffet. Like, that's the I don't mind cantaloupe, but there's no way I'm wasting valuable stomach space on cantaloupe.
I'm trying to think where I might be. I think sometimes with breakfast, like, you could be at any restaurant and there will be a little slice of cantaloupe on the side of your plate, and often it's kind of
getting warm. You pull out a fapoon and you dig into the cantaloupe.
Oh, Germany, what will you think of next? And I never really like it. I actually don't have a huge problem with cantaloupe. Cantaloupe's fine, but it has to be cold. And I don't like those slices of cantaloupe that come out and they're on the side of your plate getting kind of warm from the eggs or from being under the heat lamp that the plate was sitting under while the, you know, before the server could bring it to you. And now that I know that the very fact that these the rinds of the cantaloupe are susceptible or just like really good homes for E. coli, and these things are grown on the ground, which is something that she points out. And then knowing that this thing is now in the danger zone, I don't think I'm ever going to eat the cantaloupe on my breakfast plate ever again.
Yeah, that's a good point, because it's pretty common. You're right, and I guess I hadn't really thought of that. I also don't think I realized until this article that cantaloupe grow on the ground.
Yeah, I guess so I never sad. Really thought about it. Like, yeah. In Australia.
Look at those cantaloupe trees. Like, of course, yeah, that's not a thing. Right. They're like watermelon, basically. They grow. They're a melon. They grow on the ground. But everybody should just read this article. It's in Vox. It's great. But she goes on to talk about the fact that as you know, as by and large, buffet restaurants have really kind of gone away. Golden Corral is somehow going strong. Like, and
or
part of that,
treading water, basically, right? Not growing, yes. but basically maintains about the same number of restaurants that it's had for the past couple of decades.
But it sounds like, according to her, also really upgrading some of the restaurants.
Oh,
like
that's
remodeling
true.
Them, building in these things called food theaters, where I assume that's some kind of borderline Benihana situation, where you know, it's like there's some kind of more performative aspect to it, or you can see them kind of making the food. She has this anecdote about somebody who owns a bunch of Golden Corrals. He's a franchisee in Florida, and he's having his 50th birthday. It's just like Russian oligarch levels of excess of private planes and fanciness. So clearly, he's making some money off these Golden Corrals. Also, apparently, Golden Corral is very, very particular about who they will let buy a Golden Corral franchise, which I have to be honest is very smart, because if you only get the best of the – I mean, of course, there's a temptation when you're a company to just let anyone franchise your company, because that's just more money for you. But if you are very, very careful about who you let do it, presumably the consumer will have a good experience across the board, and it will be better for the overall health of the company. That being said, she does go in and post a bunch of really funny reviews and interesting reviews from Yelp.
Yeah, right.
She's writing about she's pulling some opinions on the Golden Corral in Freehold, New Jersey. And she says posts veer wildly between comments like "best restaurant" and "we found a hair in my grandmother's baked chicken." and then "the food is pretty amazing. My husband and I love the steak." And then someone else said, "substituted oyster crackers when they, quote, ran out of tacos and tortillas." And then somebody said, "this place is gruesome, trading in pure slop." And then she writes, "this review also quoted the Old Testament."
I forgot about that. And she also wrote, "explain?" question mark, like a teacher grading a paper. "Substituted oyster crackers when they ran out of tacos and tortillas. Explain?"
Yeah, was it a taco where you used oyster crackers as the shell?
Or the meat. I don't know.
Yeah. And then the other thing that she talks about is, and this is always, this is sort of the, you know, this is the shadow that kind of hovers over almost all restaurant experience now, from the ownership standpoint, is like things like Yelp. The fact that, like, I mean, just think about it. All of these buffet restaurants, it's just so many opportunities for things to go sideways, for food to be weird or not prepared right or rotting or you name it. And everyone's got a phone and everyone's looking for those likes. I put myself at the top of that list. So, you know, it's like, this is not like, if you go to, like, I'm here where I am in Portland, I'm right down the street from a place called Le Pigeon, It's a great, wonderful local restaurant. I don't know how many plates a night Le Pigeon does or how many turns they do of the tables, but it's, you know, fairly limited, meaning the chances of me getting a good meal at Le Pigeon are great. The chances of me having a terrible experience are pretty low. Now, remember that place we stumbled into in Missouri? Like, our hotel, we got, like, the last room in the, like, La Quinta in Springfield or something. And then, like, we were, like, kind of hungry, and so we walked next door to what we thought was a sushi restaurant, but it was, like, turned out to be the size of one city block, and it was just all, like, warmed over breaded prawns. Like, just that restaurant alone probably had, like, that day probably had 400 grievous errors that I could have photographed and put on Yelp. And that's not even to be critical of that restaurant. It's just the odds are that you're going to have some mess ups, and now those mess ups are being broadcast to the whole world via social media. And so that's apparently been especially bad for the buffet restaurant industry.
Yeah, which makes sense. And I know that that's a very complicated topic that you've talked about before, because, again, you know people in the industry and how people can really kind of hold your one bad egg, again, can hold your restaurant hostage by spreading lies or exaggerations or just focusing on the negative, which is bad. On the other hand, you know, this article sort of makes it sound like, I mean, just in this one sentence, it sort of makes it sound like the restaurants are being victimized, because, like, before you have one bad experience, you might tell 10 of your friends, and now you can tell 10,000 of your friends. And I read that, and I was like, by the way, who's this person who's eating at Golden Buffet who has 10,000 followers, and how do I get on that? How do I become that person, honestly?
Sure.
But
they call that, you know, if it's a seafood buffet, they call you a finfluencer.
Pretty good. Anyway, I don't know where I was going with that.
It's funny, though, because in the article,
like, knowledge is power. We should be able to share our experiences, but I also understand that some people really do ruin it.
She mentions just in passing that there's already 171,000 videos on TikTok under the hashtag Golden Corral. And, like, I don't feel like TikTok has been around that long. There's already been 171,000 videos put up related to Golden Corral. That's a mind-blowing stat to me.
We got to get on TikTok, by the way. We mentioned it in an email or something the other day, or an article. And since then, I got a voicemail from a listener who is just, like, over the moon. She's like, trust me, guys. Like, this is your new thing. Like, you are – she's like, it's the one time I've had addiction to my phone. I have to put down my phone after
a
couple of hours.
That's definitely what I need.
But I think more as a consumer of what's up there. And then Genevieve the other day just said, oh, my God, have you been on TikTok yet? I'm still using this really old janky phone that can barely open Google Maps anymore, and I'm not exaggerating about that. So I think I'm going to hold off on downloading until I get my new phone, which I might do next weekend. But we might have a whole new era of social media that you and I are about to jump on, probably 4 years too late.
Speaking of TikTok, and the topic that we were talking about was that song Old Town Road.
Oh, yeah. I heard
by, like, Lil Nas X, I think. Is that his name? And I was just thinking, you know, and that song first got big on TikTok. I feel like there's a real opportunity here. It's like, gonna take myself to Golden Corral, gonna eat till I can't no more. I mean, it's like, it's right there for you. It's a freebie. Golden Corral, get at this guy and have him do a Golden Corral version.
By the way, I haven't listened to this yet, but I was getting texts from our friend Tierra in Baltimore.
Is this the Billy Ray Cyrus thing?
Yeah, apparently there's a remix of it, Old Town remix, hopefully with Billy Ray Cyrus on the song. Now it'll be reclassified as country again. Eye roll emoji. Should we take a quick listen to it? I know.
Sure, why not? I tried to click on it today, and it said the file was unavailable, so I didn't know if, like, and it was from Lil Nas's Twitter feed, the one where it said file unavailable. So I wonder if he's already gotten in trouble for it.
Oh. Interesting. This is also, now I'm playing this off of Billy Ray's, I just call him Billy Ray now, his Twitter feed. This is the link that Tierra sent, and it looks like they're in the studio, and this is a cell phone vid, so I have no idea what the sound quality is going to be like. It looks like it's just a little snippet. Like a rock star, spend a lot of money on my brand new guitar. And it's got a habit, diamond rings, and Fendi sports bra. Riding down Rodeo in the Maserati sports car. Got no stress.
That's fascinating to me. We do need to kind of like turn the corner here on the end of the show. Mm-hmm. But that is fascinating to me because I swear to God, in hearing Billy Ray Cyrus sing that, it becomes very much a country song in my mind. Would you agree?
The twang, yeah, it's much more twangy. It does sound more. I mean, my argument before, and like, you know, I don't know if I'm on the wrong side of history with my quick analysis when you played that for me the other day, but like, to me, it didn't have the sound of something that would be on a country radio station. And that was basically mm-hmm. where my analysis began and ended. This definitely sounds twangier.
Right. It's just funny how just the difference in the vocal quality, and maybe because Billy Ray Cyrus is a more known quantity in country music, it's like the lyrics aren't different, the notes aren't different, unless I'm misunderstanding. It's the exact same thing, but it's now being sung by a white country guy, and it's like, oh yeah, that'd totally be on Kickin' Country or KMPS. Like,
and isn't which the is just, instrumentation kind of different though? Like, what really struck me was just, I guess this still has that twang. This is the original, right?
This is the Golden Corral cover that I'm trying to start as a thing.
Yeah,
I'm gonna take my
horse to the old town road. Yeah, maybe I was just wrong.
Hey, listen to that banjo happening.
Yeah, my memory was that there was a pretty thick beat that came in pretty quickly, but
I think
anyway.
It does eventually get, you know, the beat drops, as they might say. But anyway, okay, well, that's interesting to me. As I've said now 37,000 different ways, everybody just go over to Vox and read this article because it's full of beautiful, dazzling details, and it's just a well-written piece. I hope that this is I'm sure that Caitlin Tiffany has written many other great things that I just didn't get to read, but I'm hoping she enters the list of like writers whose names I like. If I see their byline, I'm like, I'm on this. And those writers include Katie Weaver, Taffy Brodesser, Ackner. And so Caitlin Tiffany maybe will be on that list of like, this is a really well-written story.
It really is, yeah, and well-researched.
We're out of time for adult ball pits, but that's fine because it's mostly there in the title. As Naomi Ekperigin said last night on LiveWire, she's a really funny comedian. She was talking about how she watches too many like murder shows, and you know, there's a build-up to the joke, but she goes, she's listing the different kinds of shows she's watched, Snapped, you know, this, that. She goes, I watch a show called Swamp Murders. She goes, and it's right there in the title. They find a body in the swamp, and then you work backwards. The show is 1 hour long. It's like, that's such a solid, that is such a solid joke to me. But you know, adult ball pits, you take the title and you work backwards. What it really comes down to is all these pop-ups, which I did a TV story about, and I'm fine with the TV story. And now that there's been a million other pieces about pop-ups, I've read them, and a lot of them are really good, and I'm wishing I would have been able to say a little bit more trenchant stuff about pop-ups as opposed to just being kind of like, get a load of Candytopia. But I will tell you that the ball pit is back, baby, for adults. And I think it's largely for us adults who didn't get to spend enough quality time in Chuck E. Cheese or those places. Like, you felt like my parents didn't take us to the McDonald's Playland a lot as kids. It was just not our deal, probably because my mom would have then felt pressure to buy us a 30-cent hamburger. And so, wait, I'm being more positive about my mom. My mom didn't take us to McDonald's because she knew that it was not a great thing for kids to eat multiple times a week. Thanks, Mom. And so I think for a certain kind of adult, the idea of being able to just jump into the ball pit free and easy, there's this thing called like the Rosé Mansion that's making the rounds, that's a pop-up, that's, you know, everything's white and rosé themed, and there's ball pits for grown-ups. I jumped in one at Candytopia in San Francisco that was like marshmallows, and they're just, you know, foam marshmallows. It was like therapy for me, Andrew, like no joke. Like, there was something about my body, because it was deep, it's like 5 or 6 feet deep, something about my body being in this sort of suspended animation of these marshmallows where there was like no weight being put on any part of my body. It was actually very fun and very weirdly relaxing. Like, I could have gone to sleep in this bizarre ball pit.
I remember always being kind of grossed out by them, even when I was a kid. And I think that's because and I think I'm weird about, like, seeing, like, hanging out with people with their shoes off. And I remember just, like, being very focused on the fact that all of these balls have been touched by somebody's bare feet or socked feet. And it just always felt, I always thought of the ball pit as just like the gross pit where people jump around with their shoes off.
That's amazing, because that was so far, as a little kid, that was so far from how I was viewing the world. I was just like, what? I can jump into this thing. It's just all balls. Does it even have a bottom? I don't know. This might go down to China.
It might be a quarry.
I was right. Oh, were you down at the ball quarry?
That's not bad.
Some kids never come back from the ball quarry.
It's not the worst Maine accent I've ever heard.
I don't even know who I was being there, but some version of the Pepperidge Farm guy.
Somebody in Pet Sematary. It is definitely somebody from Pet Sematary.
Absolutely.
They don't come back right.
Yeah, exactly. So those are apparently coming back because, well, adults are children again. I'm, again, one of those adult children probably. And then the other thing that they talk about in the article was that basically parents in the 80s got really afraid of their kids playing outside. And you know how these pieces are. Like, I don't know what the science is really behind that. But in like basically contained inside play spaces became a thing at some point in our country, because mostly because it felt safer to parents. And so that's a big thing. Now, that's why, you know, these kind of play experiences for kids that are indoors have really flourished over the years, just because of parents being more worried about. Like, I had this writer on the show last night, Pam Houston, who I talked about a bunch leading up to it, because Carrie, and now I am really big fans of hers. And in this book that she wrote called Deep Creek, she grew up in Pennsylvania, and her mom would say in the morning, I don't want to see you until dinner. Mm. You know? Like, and
not
that was
an angry way, but just get out of the house, go make adventures.
No, in an angry way. Her mom really sucked, as did her dad. But also, like, I mean, her point in the book is that caused her to have to go out in the world and actually really explore the world, and helped her kind of become the person that she eventually became. So it was kind of – it was because her mom was an alcoholic and didn't want to have kids and just didn't want to be bothered. But it in her life ultimately had sort of a positive impact. But that was – my mom was not, at least at that time, a diagnosed alcoholic. But she was the kind of mom who would say, like, okay, everybody out, you know, like – like, go play, go outside, leave, go do something. And when I was a kid, I've told this story many times, but I would get on my bike seemingly early in the morning on a summer day, maybe 8, 9 in the morning, and I would just start riding for some destination. And it would be like 6 o'clock at night before I would come home. And my mom had literally no idea where I was for 10 to 11 hours out of the day. That just feels like that would never happen with like an 8-year-old now.
Yeah, it's weird. I'm bummed that I missed out on that, because I grew up in the country, and you'd think even more so that my parents would just like – I mean, I roamed free to a degree, but I definitely feel like my parents knew where I was at all times. If I like kind of went missing – because I remember there were a couple of times where we would like go across the street. I didn't even know I was kind of misbehaving when I did this, but I remember – I think it was me and my sister and my neighbor Don. We're all playing somewhere, and then we went across the street and started splashing around in some, I don't know, we had some sort of adventure in some spring or creek that I didn't know was there. And then we came back, and I didn't realize that there was some panic in the house because my parents didn't know where I was. Now, if I stayed on the property and it was the country, we had tons of property, I'm sure I was gone for hours on end. But it was very clear to me. My parents were very protective, and I think that's one of the reasons why I'm kind of a high-strung guy. I think that there were very clear boundaries of – and especially like riding our bike on the road. Like, this is to their credit. These are long, windy country roads with no sidewalks and a lot of asshole drivers. And you would hear stories about people getting plowed on their bikes. Yeah, exactly. There were snakes. There were dingoes. So they were trying to keep us alive. Like, that makes sense. You know, yeah. I could understand that being a huge fear. But I also I felt like my wings were very clipped as a kid.
Not to mention that stuff like playing in the creek, it's like kids die that way, you know, like probably not infrequently. Like, when you get out in nature, nature is fun and beautiful and good for the soul, as I've been extolling of late. But as a kid, you know, you go down like a little river or creek and you get stuck under a log or you fall off something high. Like, there's actually some legit danger. And I think probably to a degree a more extant danger than this kind of weird way that we're whipped up now. Like, for instance, I don't think I was in very much danger of being abducted or or victimized in some way. Or maybe I just got lucky. But I mean, I just, my whole childhood was spent just out in the world with randos, you know, smoking cigarettes on top of the bathhouse theater by Green Lake, or just like trying to break dance or just get up to whatever trouble I could get up to. And yet I probably was not in, and again, I know we probably have listeners that things like this didn't turn out so well, but I don't think I was in that much danger. You may have actually been, if you're out in nature, depending on the kind of nature you're in, there is some stuff that could really kind of, and not to mention the cars, there is stuff out there that could really be pretty dangerous to you.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think that they were overprotective in some things. I think the creeks, I think the wilderness, the cutting through, you know, I wanted to cut through this big field to get to my friend's house, which I was allowed to do once I was older. I think that stuff, I think they were definitely overcorrecting on. The bicycle stuff, I get, although I still think I was pretty, I still think I was too old by the time I was allowed to ride the 5 miles to my only friend's house on a gearless bike.
We had, like, my whole, like, childhood sort of map of where I grew up at 77th and Aurora in Seattle was about yards I could cut through. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, it was how I viewed, it was really like my brain is very bad with directions and geolocating, which should serve us well in the outback.
Oh, great. Yeah.
But like as a kid, I had like a map quest in my brain of all of the houses I could cut through their yards. And these were, yeah, by the way, mostly fenced, but it'd be like, is the fence janky? Can I sneak under it, through it, over it? Is the gate like locked? Do they seem mean? I don't know how I would decide if they seemed mean or not. But the funny part is, I don't know how much time I was saving, but I cut through I lived in a very dense urban neighborhood. I mean, houses were 10 feet apart. Well, not really, probably 20 feet apart. And I was just always cutting through yards all the time. And almost all of these yards were gated and fenced, and I just didn't care. And it would be like, I don't know if really saving much time, but it was certainly an adventure.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that sounds cool. That sounds like an ideal childhood. By the way, quick note. I looked up tbtl.au, and it doesn't seem to be a website. Should we get that?
Probably. Yeah, why not? tbtl.au.
I don't know if you let's can. Do you it. Buy an AU if you're not in Australia?
Well, let's find out after the show. Well, I'll will you do a little cursory? Well, no, you know what? I'll do it because you're going to be posting the show. That should be your focus. I will check out what the legality of us purchasing tbtl.au is, and then we can point it. Because you know what? We're going to have to pretty soon figure out what are we going to tell people in Australia about what the flip we're doing there? Because it's going to come up. I mean, at first, I don't know how many humans we're going to see once we get north of Adelaide. But we're going to have to figure out how do we describe this to people? Do we describe it to people? Do we just say that we're Mormon missionaries? Like, what's our plan here? Like when we were a random outback roustabout asked us, you know, what are you doing here? Are you going to see a lady from Fiji? Okay, I'll stop. I'm sorry. I apologize. Good that was God. Hard for everyone.
I was scared of the snakes. don't forget, Larima had a whole podcast produced about it and the mysteries. So I think once we get up there, you know what I mean? People are pretty familiar.
That's what
I
we
mean,
should interview.
Maybe you just,
oh, my God.
Yeah.
Andrew. This is great.
We should talk
this
to the person
see,
who did the
we need
podcast.
To talk to the journalism student and the journalism professor that made Lost in Larima, not even about Larima, but about driving there. Like,
yeah,
yo, what's the deal? How do you do this? Because we know that they know how to get to Larima because they actually went there. So,
yeah.
See, I think we can do this. I think it can happen. All right, let's do some music for the listeners' weekend. Andrew, would you mind starting so that I can think of my suggestion for music for your weekend?
I would love to. I'm interested in knowing what you think of this. What I'm doing here is a little bit sketchy, by the way. I had some reservations about playing this because what I'm going to play for you is actually audio that I've pulled from another podcast. You know that I listen to Comedy Bang Bang all the time, right? And Scott Aukerman hosts it, and it's a bunch of comedians who come on, and it's 10 years old, just like I think it's almost the exact same age as TBTL.
And it's a silly, I would say, the same amount of popularity.
Yeah, they're getting there, certainly.
ding, ding, ding.
It's a really silly show. And I've if I've ever heard a live musician on it, which I don't remember hearing, it would have been goofy in some way, like somebody singing silly songs. But he had on this musician last week who I had not heard of before, whose name is Dan Mangan, M-A-N-G-A-N, Dan Mangan. And apparently he's a longtime friend of the show. Scott just listened to his record when a publicist sent it to him years and years ago, and he said, I like it. Come on the show and play it. And so he's been a regular guest since, I guess. And this is the first time I heard him on. And it really reminded me of when I was working at New Hampshire Public Radio and we'd have people in. You might hear an album from somebody and be like, ah, I don't know if this is for me. But then they just come in just with their guitar, just a tiny bit of reverb on their voice, and they just do it raw right there in the studio. And it just... it's much more magical. And so I'm listening to Comedy Bang Bang. This guy's songs are kind of serious, as you'll hear. I went and I listened to the record later, which is good, and I do recommend it. But there's something about him just performing totally stripped down to just him and an acoustic guitar. So I'm going to play this for you. This is from Comedy Bang Bang. The artist is Dan Mangan, and the song is called Troubled Mind. And I think you're going to be a little surprised, Luke, because it doesn't sound like the type of stuff I usually play, but it's speaking to me.
I can take the heat, cause I got a troubled mind. History repeats, and you know I got a troubled mind. And it won't let up, it's like a bad dream. Say I got a troubled mind. I'm shaking like a sad teen. Gotta say I got a troubled mind. What the hell is wrong with everybody right now? Everywhere I look, it's the same sound. Haunted by the melody, melody, haunted by the melody, melody. Sometimes it gets ahead of me, head of my mind, it gets ahead of me, gets ahead of me. Haunted by the melody, the melody, haunted by the melody.
I don't know if legally I'm allowed
like
to play
that
music from other people's podcasts, but support Comedy Bang Bang, support Dan Mangan, check out the album, and that song is called Troubled Mind. His new album is called More or Less.
See, that is very, as a World's Tallest Man fan and a fan of a lot of kind of singer-songwriter stuff, that's very much up my alley. So we'll add that to the Australia playlist.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Oh,
and again, I want to say you will like the album, so I recommend checking it out, but this is the first one I heard and I just couldn't get off it. The other thing being, you want to make a playlist?
I want you to make a playlist. One of the most fun parts of the RV trip was listening to, not to make work for you, but mm-hmm. I love the playlist. I think you actually made it for a trip to St. Paul, but we played it a lot on the RV trip, and it was like seriously I remain a huge fan of many of the songs that I heard about for the first time on that mixtape. So maybe you can make another playlist for Australia.
What we should do, though, well, I guess you can download things to your phone, too. I might even burn a CD because,
yes.
Honestly, once you're out there and you lose your cell connection, you can't just be bopping around on Spotify.
But you have to remember the CDs spin in the opposite direction. So factor that in. All right. I am looking out at just a torrential downpour, and it is gloomy and gray here in Portland today. It is raining like porta potties being lowered down from skyscrapers.
Yeah, what color is the rain?
but I wanted to suggest a song that it makes me feel hopeful for summer, and it's by Telekinesis, a band that we've had, and Michael, a guy who we've had on the show many times, a wonderful friend of the show. He's got a song, Telekinesis has a song called All of a Sudden, and I just love this. It's summery. I'm suggesting this in a sort of aspirational way, even though the weather here in Portland, Oregon does not reflect this mood. I'm trying to force the weather into becoming more like the mood of this song. So could you favor us with that, All of a Sudden, by Telekinesis?
All of a sudden it's the summertime.
man. It's so hard to not just let the song run.
Yeah, oh, right? So good. Yeah.
He has this part at the end of the song that I'm just the biggest sucker for, which is where everything except just the drums, I think, goes out. In other words, like, you know what I mean? Most of the instrumentation falls away. And maybe it's just him and the guitar. I can't remember what instrument it is, but it just gets very, very stripped down. And I love it when songs do that. There's got to be a... There's got to be some kind of a, you know, term of art for that, where you just kind of like take out most of the other things and it's just the person's voice over like a simple guitar lick. That just has the exact effect on me it's supposed to.
Ironically, I'm going to explain this even though it's not going to translate. Would you just call that a breakdown? Like, I think of that
as a
breakdown.
I mean, is that what
breakdown
means? I always thought, I guess I kind of, yeah, it probably is a breakdown. I think I thought of breakdown as being more like an instrument solo, like a drum breakdown. But you're right. That's probably is what it's called. It's sort of like the This American Life thing of like the music stopping and then the person keeps talking and you're like, now I'm paying maximum attention because there was music and talking and now there is just talking. And all of a sudden, this just got very important. It's like the musical equivalent of that.
Okay, and now here's why this is kind of ironic, and I think maybe I can even play it. So that that song I just played for you, Dan Mangan, on the show, I'm sorry I'm doing this. I apologize in advance, everybody. On the show, I told you everybody's kind of in character often. Well, he stayed as Dan Mangan, but the comedians will come on. They'll interview as themselves, and then they'll just pretend like they leave and they come back as somebody else. It's a very, very silly show. The one guy's character, one of the comedians who was on during this Dan Mangan episode, I can't remember his name, but he claimed to be the guy who said, "Now it's time for a breakdown" on the En Vogue song. And that was like his bit. He's like, "The now it's time for a breakdown." And they were riffing on that. And then when Dan was playing his first song, he said, "I'm going to need a breakdown at some point in this song." And he did just stop. It was a hilarious moment in the show. I think I've got it queued up here. So this is from a song called Peaks and Valleys. If you don't mind, please be.
I don't.
Please work, Walsh.
And keep you afloat as you row that boat until you both let go.
Now it's time for a breakdown.
Someday.
I don't know if that translates. Like, this show has a spell on me, man. I love that show. Yes. I mean, I honestly, I don't know what I would do if this show went away.
Wow. And you're not talking about TBTL right now. You're talking about Comedy
I Bang literally Bang. Wouldn't know what I would do if TBTL went away. I would be very, very
You'd
sad.
You'd have more time for Comedy Bang Bang.
Yeah. No, but honestly, my hearing this might sound odd, but hearing people say very nice things about TBTL and the relationship that they've built with the show and we've built with them reminds me of the private relationship I have with Comedy Bang Bang. I can't explain it. It's kind of like the Stern thing too. It's like it's a whole world. I can't really explain what the magic is. You listen to 100 shows and you suddenly realize I can't live without it, and it only takes 100 shows to get there. But it's just a whole universe that I don't know. Things are – I can't explain why certain things are funny because they're like seven – they're built upon 17 jokes, none of which I can explain.
Well, I mean, that's why when people say nice things about TBTL being a big part of their life, it means so much to me because I grew up and you know, to this day have radio shows that are like that for me. Mm-hmm. And the analogy or the story that I've shared a bunch of times was back when Loveline – was kind of at its peak, I would say, which was like a young Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew. And it was, you know, on, I think it might have actually been on K-Rock in LA, which is how, you know, because Adam was like a character on Kevin and Bean. Like he would call in and do things. It's amazing how many, like Jimmy Kimmel, and there's just like a long list of people who passed through the Kevin and Bean universe. But anyway, I would schedule, and it was 2 hours. And it was just people calling in with love and sex advice questions. And I was there really just to hear Adam Carolla riffing. I would schedule my whole day around it. I'd be like, well, I got to do this project and it's going to be tedious. I'll do it from 10 p.m. till midnight because then I can listen to Loveline and I will be transported. And I felt that way about the Don and Mike show when it was happening. And now there's lots of podcasts that are like that for me. You know, Chris Hayes' show is something that like I look forward to it all week, and I actually have a special way that I listen to it, which is like I'm walking the dog. It's very meditative for me, but I can also concentrate on what's going on. Like if I'm mowing the lawn, I can listen to baseball because I don't have to concentrate as hard, and the lawnmower is kind of loud. I have all these weird scenarios where I listen to certain kinds of things. But anyway, know that TBTL is that for people, it means so much to me because there are things that are that to me, and I know how much I treasure them and look forward to them, and they get me through tough times, and they make things that suck a little bit less sucky, you know. So so it's really meaningful, I think, to us when we hear that from people because we can really relate.
Yeah, amen, amen. Speaking of listeners, I assume you have listener-suggested music.
I do, and it's a little bit of a I would say it's a bit of a sad note, maybe to end the show, but I think it's a note worth noting because I'd actually heard about this person's passing through the grapevine of various people in Port Townsend who Carrie and I know, our friend Jet, among others, who play music there. But listener Levi says, "Hey fellas, I found out yesterday that my friend Jared Bramson of the Port Townsend band Solvents died this week. He was a wonderful musician and human who will be dearly missed by many, especially his wife and daughters. I thought it might be nice to play one of their tunes this week." And so I did a little poking around, Andrew, on the Solvents Bandcamp page, and they have an album called Manresa Castle, which is like just an awesomely weird thing in Port Townsend, the Manresa Castle. Like it's sort of like it's falling apart, but it's also got all this history to it, and you can stay there, and it's like weirdly cheap. Carrie and I stayed there on New Year's Eve one time, and it didn't not have a The Shining vibe when we were there.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So I love that this band. I love that this band was from Port Townsend, and that they actually had an album called Manresa Castle. This is the first track off of that album. I think it's called "All Your Demons Pulling." So there you go. And this will be the listener suggestions from listener Levi, and it's the band Solvents from Port Townsend.
That's sad. I'm sorry. End. Yeah, I do want to say though that's a real bummer. I don't know what the circumstances were, but that is sad. So my heart goes out to them and to Levi.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, you know, I officially declare nobody else in the listener audience or even friends of the listeners passing away for a minimum. Wait, when are we going to be in Australia?
Let's call it 8 weeks to give me. It's not quite 8 weeks.
For a minimum of 8 weeks. I can't promise we'll survive the outback. So that's where I may break our own rule. But let's get 8 weeks of everybody staying hale and hearty, please, if possible.
Amen.
Because I feel like we've been wrapping up a lot of shows with memorializing people. And frankly, it's too much. So anyway, this song is actually pretty cool. I hadn't heard of this band before, but I enjoyed this. The Bandcamp page says, "We're a music duo group from Port Townsend. Our influences range from Graham Parsons to Husker Du." And I'm like, okay, you had me at Husker Du. So that's how we'll end the week. Thank you for listening, everybody. Thanks for being part of TBTL. We are going to be right back here on Monday with more Imaginary Radio, presumably with a whole new passel of scared emails from listeners in Australia, which we'll have to go through and try to figure out one at a time. So anyway, have a great weekend, everybody. Go Mariners, go eat a bagel, and please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all. And I'll shake the gods till they shatter.
power out.